Blog Talk Radio.
Double, 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 double,
green.
Double. So she didn't have a daughter, so she didn't have a son. She said the lift doesn't run, run up the stairs and come. And if it don't come quick, you're not gonna know that fun. So I grab a bunch of clothes and I started to run. Here I come, whoa. 2 months later, she said, come and get your son. Cause I don't want your baby to come tie me down. Now because you are old and I am young. Yes, while I'm young, yes, I wanna have some fun. Run me down, should live out a little. I'm broad, I'm broad, I'm broader than Broadway. Yes, I'm broad, I'm broad, I'm broader than Broadway. When you go to Volcano, it's like a stage show. You have man that swing DJ and blow. Pull it down the radio, yo, yo. Swing, and the intercom rolls, it tell me to come. So she didn't have a daughter, she did have a son. She said the lift doesn't run. And come, and if you don't come quick, you're not gonna see your son. So I grab a bunch of fruit and I start.
Long-awaited decision in the Huey Newton murder trial, which has drawn worldwide attention, is now very near. The jury of 7 women and 5 men are deliberating the fate of the Black Panther leader on the 8th floor of that building. It is their job to decide whether he is guilty of killing Oakland policeman John Fry and wounding Officer Herbert Haynes in a pre-dawn shootout last October 28th. 2 floors above the jury in his cell, Huey Newton, who has made almost no show of emotion during the 8 weeks of trial, calmly awaits the decision of the jury. I talked to Newton in the jail.
As far as the proceedings thus far, that the courts have only reflected the racist attitude of the general power structure, that I haven't received a fair trial, that I should not have been indicted in the first place. I was indicted by a blue ribbon grand jury, a middle-class white grand jury that did not represent a cross-section of the community. And
you say you don't feel you've had a fair trial?
No.
Why?
Number one, that the judge has been very racist throughout the proceeding, very pro-prosecution, that I don't feel that I should have been tried at all. And if I had been tried, if there was an inkling of reason to try me, I should not have been tried for first-degree murder. That if the judge had not been a racist, that he would have amended the charges to a manslaughter, perhaps. The very fact that he didn't dismiss the whole charge reflects his racism.
Some of your supporters have said that the trial, that you are a political prisoner,
that are oppressing people of color all over the world, and on local levels of police, fascist police, are suppressing, repressing the white revolutionaries as well as the blacks who speak of and who are attempting to attain liberation. So I am not standing for violence, but I do stand for self-defense.
Back to the trial for one moment.
Could you just keep on talking?
What about your future? You're on the street next week.
I will continue to organize the black community in a political fashion. I will help in the campaign of Eldridge Cleaver for president, in my own campaign for 7th Congressional District. And I think this will be a large job because it's going to be done from a grassroots level, from door to door in the community. It will we'll consider the people on 7th Street who stand on the corners, who have lost all faith in this society, and matter of fact, all other, we will attempt to rehabilitate them, to show them that there is possibly some gains in political action, and if it's sincere, and if the black people have exclusive control of it within their community. So in my campaign.
You say, you got enough, Steve?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Separated from my language, separated from my In this jungle, oh, warrior's music, oh. Me wake up from a dream, couldn't go back to sleep. Me sit up and a prayer situation now comes. And me always dead to see them, but me not see them in a my tribulation. Oh, it's so funny that the people them would tell yourself to trust them. You never ever get them when you call them. I just you and the problem. In this jungle, every man feed themselves so prepared for fight. Jungle, hey, give thanks to the one for truth and life. Jungle, the victory's there on the battlefield. Real warriors keep it real. Me get a flat down the road, through me car overload. Me have the spear on my phone, but she empty. Maybe to me here, raga, me sure never press. People drive past, nah help me. And the ones who pretend to care, them just all about the money, yeah. Here comes the cops who want to kid me. Ain't nothing but this, no funny. In this jungle, every man see themselves so prepared for fight. Jungle, hey, give thanks to the ones for truth to life. Jungle, the victory's there on the battlefield. Real warriors keep it real. In this jungle, things I never ever wanna see. Many true characters concealed. Flattering lips with smiling faces. Pass them all the while in different places. In this jungle, everyone seems to ever need an agenda. Hey, so why you hunting for mine? Nah, go on like some blind. In this jungle, every man see themselves so prepared for fight. Jungle, hey, give thanks to the ones for true to life. Jungle, the victory's there on the battlefield. Real warriors keep it real. In this jungle. Up from a dream, couldn't go back to sleep. Me sit up and a prayer situation now comes. And me always dead for them, but me not see them in a my tribulation. Oh, it's so funny that the people them would tell yourself to trust them. You never ever get them when you call them. I just you and the problem. In this jungle, every man feed themselves so prepared for fight. Jungle, hey, give thanks to the ones for true to life. Jungle, the victory's there on the battlefield. Real warriors keep it real. In this jungle, every man see themselves so prepared for fight. Jungle, hey, give thanks to the ones for true to life. Jungle, the victory's there on the battlefield. Real warriors keep it real.
Consciousness. Without human consciousness, there is no world. It is the presence of human consciousness that brings meaning into the world. Without human beings in this world, conscious human beings in this world, in effect, there would not be a world. We bring the world into being through our consciousness. And through our consciousness, we create the world we live in. Out of the totality of reality, our consciousness cuts out a world that's a bit itself. In other words, the kind of world you exist in reflects the kind of consciousness that you have. And notice, if you change your consciousness or change your values and orientation, you enter into a different world. You interact with different people. People often that you didn't even know existed in the world. Social situations that you might not have even recognized until you entered into a new level of consciousness. You see people, say, for instance, who become addicted, say, to crack or something, and now enter into a whole world and enter into a whole social system that before they became addicted, they hardly noticed. They didn't know what it was all about. And they picked up new friends and new relations, whole new ways of acting, whole new purposes in life. They lost old friends, broke with old families, all kinds of things. In other words, the consciousness, that addictive consciousness, brought into the world a new foreground and put other things into the background. Therefore, man's consciousness is a creative act. And the kind of consciousness you have will determine the kind of world you create. And consequently, when you look at the world that we live in, African people, we must recognize to a great extent it is a world of our own creation. It is a world that has been generated by the type of consciousness we've been permitted to be instilled in us as a people. Consciousness.
Okay, we ready. Chinese people are very humane and friendly people. They attempt to understand all ignorance and backwardness. I would suspect and anticipate that Richard Nixon will receive a warm welcome, but that has no indication of what the results of the talks might be. The talks might be successful, or they might fail, but it will depend upon the attitude and the kind of language that Richard Nixon will use. Certainly, he cannot be trigger happy as he was in Attica, because the Chinese people are strong people, and their land is very fertile. We know that the ruling circle in this country will only take advantage of victims, such as the prisoners in Attica, the guards in Attica, and the Vietnamese people and black people in this country, as well as poor white people.
The party is at this time engaged in a struggle of gaining representation in the institutions in our community. And according to our 10-point program, this was always our fight. We've been misrepresented by the press for a long time, but the truth always finds its way out. And I think that history will justify our past actions, and certainly history condemns things and people by eliminating them. The party is still very much alive and kicking, and I think we must have done something right. We plan to use whatever means that's effective and sufficient in order to gain our desires. We're not, of course, we can't be serious about the law of this country if the country itself is not serious about it. I think first we have to make them serious about the law, and many of the laws that they're serious about are bad laws, so we have to change those. But we're not going to, I don't think it should be required of us to limit our activities within certain behaviors prescribed by this corrupt system. I think we'll use the most appropriate approach to the resolution of the contradiction that's here in the United States.
Well, in the first place, that I have absolutely no power as an individual. The power is with the people. So the real question is that what are the people going to do? I said we're going to unite and become very strong, and we're going to free all political prisoners and prisoners of war. We'll free the Soledad Brothers Three. That's Cluche, Drumgo, Fleeter Drumgo, and George Jackson. And all of the other brothers there at Soledad and white prisoners also have a case, because the prisons are not rehabilitation centers. They are no more than concentration camps. I plan to visit Bobby Seale, the chairman, and all of our party members who are in prison, and also many other political prisoners and prisoners of war. I think that includes everyone who's in prison. I would like to visit them. In the people's interest, because...
George Jackson, age 29, California Adult Authority inmate A63837, imprisoned January 12, 1960, offense second-degree robbery.
Convicted of stealing $72 from a petrol station, Jackson had a juvenile record. He was advised to plead guilty to get a lighter sentence.
Sentence 1 year to life. Term served 11 years, 7 months, 7 years in solitary confinement.
One to life means the convict is eligible for parole each year, subject to the judgment of a parole board. Jackson was refused parole 8 times.
January 1970. Charged with the murder of a prison guard. Future, if convicted, death row.
With 2 fellow prisoners, Jackson allegedly killed a prison guard in reprisal for the shooting of other convicts. The 3, George Jackson, Fleeter Drumgo, and John Cluche, became known as the Soledad Brothers.
August 21st, 1971, San Quentin. 3 guards and 2 prisoners killed in an alleged escape attempt. George Jackson shot dead.
Time seems to be passing much faster these last few months. Wonder where it's running to. What's building? Well, I'm positively displeased, and I'm positively destined to remain so. Someone may have to get hurt, but power to the people. George.
Right about now, NWA quarters in full effect. Judge Gray residing. In the case of NWA versus the police department, prosecuting attorneys are MC Brand, Ice Cube, and Easy Motherfucking E.
Order, order, order. Ice Cube, take the motherfucking stand. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help your black ass?
You goddamn right.
But won't you tell everybody what the fuck you gotta say?
Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. And thrown in jail, we can go toe to toe in the middle of a cell. Fucking with me cause I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager. Searching my car, looking for the plotter. Thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. You'd rather see me in the pen than me and Lorenzo rolling in a Benzo. Be the police out of shape, and when I finish, bring the yellow tape to take off the scene of the slaughter. Still getting swole up bread and water. I don't know if they fags or what. Such a nigga down and grabbing his nuts. And on the other hand, without a gun, it can't get none. But don't let it be a black and a white one, cause they'll slam you down to the street top. Black police showing out for the white cop.
Waiting to get shot by me or another nigga. And with a gat, it don't matter if he's smaller or bigger. And as y'all know, E's here the rule. Whenever I'm rolling, keep looking in the mirror. And it's on cue, yo, so I can hear a dumb motherfucker with a gun. And if I'm rolling off the eight, he'll be the one that I take out and then get away. While I'm driving off laughing, this is what I'll say. Fuck the police.
Being a redneck, white bread, chicken shit, motherfucker.
That's a lie. That's a goddamn lie.
Get him out of here.
I want that dead.
Get him the fuck out of my face.
I want that dead.
Out right now.
Fuck you, you black motherfucker.
Fuck the police. Fuck the police. Fuck the police.
Black power, black nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People, weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, political party national chair, Nat Turner, co-host myself, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, and our engineers on the ones and twos, Sister Amon, a National Minister of Communication, calling each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, an update on Mother Africa. Again, tonight's topic, an update on Mother Africa. Press 1 to participate if you want to get on with your comment. We're going to open up our phone lines to our national chair, Nat Turner. Black power, Uhuru, all power to the people, comrade. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me, brother?
Yes, sir. You're
right. Black power, all
right
power to the people. The show, we're going to try to just give some update on the continent. Time to time, we try to, just keep, our people over there, over the ocean in mind. The Pan-Africanist idea, the international, just a struggle, or make no distinctions, whether we from Southern Africa. I had to correct that, this shit about some country called South Africa. Yeah, that's bullshit, whether you're in Southern Africa, West Africa, Central Africa, whatever, there's black and brown indigenous populations that still exist in Northern Africa also. From there to America, to the American decadence, the descendants of black and brown people who had been brought here by force over the Atlantic Ocean, and also those the indigenous black and brown people who had already been here. They make no distinction by what tribe name, what affiliation or what classification or term or designation that we go under. Since we've been here, we've gone from Negro to niggers, or niggers the Negroes, to black Americans, to Afro-Americans, now African-American, so forth. But Africa is our homeland, our indigenous homeland, our original homeland, political party. We claim Africa over any other region or country or continent or whatever. But at the same time, we recognize that we are also the indigenous people on the earth. These other continents, even Europe, even what is now made up as Europe. Europe is no more, no less than West Asia, which was taken over violently by the Europeans, by the barbarians, and named Europe, which, by the way, was named after a black goddess named Europa. But, you know, just an update on Mother Africa. And we dearly love the richest, wealthiest continents on this planet, or this place that we know as Earth, you know. And the condition, the wretched conditions that our people find themselves in there, it's really quite irrational, you know, very contradictory, you know, to have the richest geographical landmass and the poorest people. I always, you know, start off, you know, just try to paint a basic picture. And of course, you know, a lot of things are, you know, they they go through my mind and stuff, and I try to not get so bombarded, you know, with all of these things, and try to space them out to make sense of the shit. To paint a picture for those of us who are not as advanced, some of us are, that is, you know, our understanding of a political education, you know, being politicized, and of course, this is the process on the road to liberation that we gladly accept as attempting to be part of the solution, attempting to be a component of the whole, recognizing political education as the key. I mean, we come once again using history as a measuring stick, or clips rather, that were being played right before we started, that is verbally. You hear the revolutionary and genius Huey P. Newton explain some things. Some people say that the elder was very scientific, a philosopher, studied a great many things, and he developed an impeccable understanding, which resulted in the treatment that the Black Panther Party had received, unlike any of the other groups, except for one or two other groups. But just an understanding, which we also applied to our original homeland, our motherland, you know. And there are a number of things that we want to try to bring across. As of late, there's been this phenomenon that has been taking place on the continent. In the form of what is referred to as a coup. You know, the coups that have been orchestrated on the continent, certain countries and certain areas. And the one that seems to stand out most is the one in Burkina. Faso, successfully orchestrated by Ibrahim Traoré, a brilliant young soldier, brother, you know. And we hope that what has happened in Burkina Faso is as practical, as realistic as genuine as possible. There's been a history of coups in Africa, you know. And some of those coups have been orchestrated by unseen forces. And so sometimes it's kind of tricky, you know, it's kind of difficult sometimes to discern between the two unless we get behind the scenes and examine such coups, you know, from the grassroots up. And of course, there's always, you know, reasons why. The imperialists, their only ambition, their only objective for being in Africa is the continued rape and plunder of the mother continent, of its plenteous natural resources. Today, you know, science and technology craze is predicated on you know, iPads and whatnot, you know, laptops, the extraordinary. But I have to be careful with some of these terms, because I could give them no satisfaction in anything. I would say that it's extraordinary to see the type of social engineering that has come from it as a result. But these electronics and these space age phones and whatnot are chiefly dependent on one thing, one ingredient, and that is a ingredient known as coltan. And this coltan is plentiful in Central Africa, you know, what is referred to as Congo, Central African Republic. And so the corporation's only objective and only goal, the telecommunications companies, besides copper, is their only concern. Yeah. And there's been so-called leadership that has acquiesced to the foreign, to the imperialists, to the capitalists. And as a result, over time, it naturally happens that the people will have been run out of patience, the people will have run out of any sense of diplomacy or even nonviolence, you know, trying to reason with those who in actuality are unreasonable or cannot be reasoned with because of their ambitions, not because of some type of normal physical thing. Any two people can reason with each other. But there just happens to be two types of people, those who don't know how to reason and those who don't want to know how to reason, which therefore makes it impossible for two people to reason, which leads to tension. Tension turns into static. Static escalates into pre-stage conflict. And the pre-stage conflict becomes full-blown, like we are told that HIV leads to full-blown AIDS. And so it naturally happens that there is a internal or internecine strife or warfare that takes place, and one has to be the victor, the other has to be the loser. And so this is what has been taking place in parts of the continent. You know, just to give some idea, in certain countries, even, well, I'd mentioned the case of Burkina Faso, West Africa, the country of Chad, which is more toward North Central Africa. In April 2021, as a result of internal war, contradictions of disagreements on policy, disagreements on the leadership and security. You know, the people needing security, and that security is not monolithic. It's it comes in various forms. So, as a situation, that as a result of that, led to the coup in Chad, April 2021, in the country of Mali, which is another North African country. Mali is once the home of civilizations or kingdoms that existed in that part of Africa 1,000 years ago, it's an extraordinary place. But in August 2020, there was a coup, and which led on to another coup, going on approaching a year later in 2021 of May. And of course, the internal strife, again, over ideological positions, which is what led to that. It is these things where, the so-called West, the Europeans, they have these terminologies that they use, and of course it can never be anything that can shine any positive light on our people in these countries in Africa. But they use such terms as a military junta, but it's not spelled the way that it's pronounced. Some people will just pronounce it for what it is, junta. And some people will say, junta, but I think it's a proper pronunciation of junta, which I think it may be a French term somewhere along that. Of course, the French has been in Africa, the physical presence of colonialism, the confiscation of Africa due to the so-called scramble for Africa in the late 1880s. These military juntas that take place, these military coups and takeovers, the ousting of so-called presidents on the part of the younger blood, opposed to the older blood, these old blind. And so there's this phenomenon that's taking place where may not be in all cases, but in you get the perception that this younger blood, 40-ish, 30-ish, and 40-ish, is rising. There's a rise in a certain type of resistance or attitude. Again, it comes to a head when the people can no longer sustain type of bullshit, that they've been subjected to, being fed nothing but rhetoric, or rhetoric if not totally rhetoric. In other words, more things change than what they seem to stay the same. And I always like to use the analogy of someone who was, into fitness, and they used to, go out and run, around the track at the park or along the lake, whatever. And so they, went and bought them one of them high tech, whatever, treadmills. So this Peloton shit is commercials now. And so they, they can run in their own house, but they're on the treadmill running, but they ain't really going anywhere. So that's what the people have been subjected to. And so, of course, it's always boiled down to ideology. The number of factors that on the surface that are not seen, that are not recognized, and it requires those who have a true understanding of the situation in order to be able to correct it. in order to be able to throw off the yoke of oppression. And oppression can, in Africa, has been white men in black face, those who have been willing to sell their souls to the highest bidder, or as understood by, you know, those who practice their religions, as you know, is understood as selling one's soul to the devil, you know, sort of like the story of Judas who took the 30 shekels of silver to betray Jesus. Jesus is the nation, and Judas is the selfish so-called ruler or president who is taking the 30 shekels of silver from the imperialists, led chiefly by what is referred to as the Anglo-American establishment. And that's just terminology for Britain slash America, who are just basically separated by a huge body of water known as the Atlantic Ocean. And these are the, you know, the leaders. You know, the perception that you get. Of course, you know, the French are right on their heels. And during the colonial period, the atmosphere had become right. You know, to seize the time to throw off the yoke of imperialism. And so there was a series of revolutionary campaigns throughout Africa, which led to what the Europeans would have us believe, you know, the first democracy in the Congo, and the first democracy in Zimbabwe and whatnot. You know, they love to flatter themselves, you know, as though African people had never known what democracy was before. For the simple fact that the word democracy is based on an African term, and this African term was basically one of the names of the God we know. And the Greeks, who had been perfect copiers their whole lives in relation to specifically ancient Kemet, had been lifting terminologies and whatnot from the African population there. That is how they got around to the word demos, which is the predicate of what is referred to now as we speak in so-called English as democracy. And the word demos just simply means the people. It is a word that refers to humanity. You can even say mankind, or man, woman, child as a group, or as a people, a community of people. And this is the same definition and explanation that the word in Kemet understood and was expressed by. The T and the D in our languages is basically the same. And so some cases you will see it spelled with a T. In other cases, you would also see it spelled with a D. And so there's no such thing that the Europeans introduced democracy to African people on the continent. What the Europeans have sought out to do, what the Europeans have planned to do, because they've been thinking ahead of time, that what they had sought out to do was get people to believe that if they voted, then they had a democracy. That if they didn't vote, they didn't have a democracy. And the strange part about that is this. In Britain, in London, in Great Britain, in Greater Britain, there's this parliament and this voting process and whatnot. And but at the same time, Britain also has a king and the queen, a royal family. And this royal family has been in rulership since Lord knows when. But no one says anything when it comes to Great Britain. But the minute an African leader who has been ruling ahead of his country, homeland, for 20, 30 years, the Europeans have mastered the art of propaganda to get the world, the international community, to internalize this thing about dictatorship and authoritarianism, totalitarianism, all this of absolute rule. You take Gaddafi, for instance. Gaddafi had been one of those who made a move to free Libya from its conditions, and in the place of that, developed people's programs, people's councils and assemblies that dealt with pretty much all the possibles within Libyan society. And of course, Libya being a Muslim led country, predicated on the Islamic belief, and therefore the, you know, their holy Bible referred to as the Quran. But Gaddafi was a genius. And it wasn't because Gaddafi was a dictator or Gaddafi had been in rulership for 30, 40 years that the Europeans had a problem with Gaddafi. There was no problem with Gaddafi only till Gaddafi got to understand imperialism and the ways and functions of capitalism, which is therefore a selfish mode of production. It doesn't include the collective masses of the people. Only a handful. And it is only at that point that the Europeans had become ensconced, you know, with Gaddafi. He had learned to play the game. He had learned to understand the whims of capitalism. What is the whims of capitalism? Profit mode. Is their religion. And capitalism is their Bible. And realizing that and understanding the importance of material resources, natural resources in Libya, particularly the oil, that Gaddafi had begun to set up a defense mechanism against the imperial. And it's only because of that that Gaddafi was then projected as a dictator, and that the people had been living under a dictator, and therefore they had no democracy, because the people didn't have a voting system. But when you look at the tail of the tape from the inside, from the grassroots, from the bottom up, what do you see? So they had to pull a coup against Gaddafi. You pull the coup against Gaddafi, of course, it would never work without corporate control media propaganda. But in the process of Gaddafi's leadership, Gaddafi had authored a book called The Green Book. And then in this Green Book, he lays out the ideological framework of what actually is a democracy, such as establishing women's councils, specifically on women's conditions and women's positions within society, and the grievances of women. See, it's those such things that were set up that had kept Libya in the position to challenge the so-called West. Monetary system based on gold, and then understanding the crucial component of communications, telecommunications. And so therefore establishing the ability to construct satellites and to put Libya and therefore the rest of Africa in some type of position to control its own telecommunications system. And it was because of that the Europeans saw fit to get rid of Gaddafi. Whereas before, they had been sort of courting Gaddafi because of the oil. And so this is just an example of the colonial period, which led to the revolutionary overthrows of puppet governments in the 50s, in the 60s. And that the Europeans had to revamp themselves, they had to reinvent themselves, had to recreate themselves in terms of rule. This is what we refer to today as neocolonialism, the new colonialism in a way much more sophisticated form. And so some of the predicate in some of these coups is predicated on understanding neocolonialism. Therefore, those who are Hershey bar chocolate but have the Western mindset. One of the things that the Europeans have also been able to pull off is taking young African brothers and sisters and creating this thing called the International Exchange Program in the so-called collegiate world, what they refer to as multiculturalism, that a lot of our people have bought into. And so over the past 10 years, I would at least say, you see this huge influx of African brothers and sisters in America, North America. And you can even notice this influx, this presence in collegiate basketball, where now you're starting to see, you know, these games that are televised by CBS and whatnot, the NAACP, you know, the NCAA tournament, whatever. You start to notice these African last names on the back of these jerseys and these sportscasters, you know, who are broadcasting the game, and they're sort of having fun, you know, with trying to pronounce the names and whatnot, because the names are composed of 15, 20 letters. And so you see that. That is not by coincidence. That is by design, because that's how an empire operates. But what is the ultimate motive and purpose and function of that? The ultimate goal and motive and function of it is to produce future African leadership that would do the bidding of the imperialists of the so-called West. And this is why they are allowed to enter the country and attend these universities under sports and scholarships. And some of them have went on to make it in the so-called NBA. You know, this young phenomenon that plays for the Milwaukee Bucks, for instance, whose last name they're always murdering when trying to pronounce it. You know, even Chris Webber, you know, the former NBA, black NBA basketball player sometimes, you know. But that's just an example, you know. His first name, you know, was tend to have a Greek root to it, but it is his last name. Let me see if I can try to pronounce it like the brothers would say. Giannis Antetokounmpo. Giannis Antetokounmpo would be something like how they would pronounce it in the context, because the U is like two O's. Like, see. But anyway, here's an example of being allowed into the U.S. System and prosper and make it. So they can take him and make him say, look, the Africans have arrived. They have come up to do what? To bend your mind away from the fact that the colonialists are still there, that the imperialists are still there, to make you think that the Africans have come up. There's this magazine, let's see if I can get this magazine, National Geographic magazine. And I think I still have this copy of this, but this one particular copy had really grabbed my attention, where they went into, you know, like these West African countries, you know, like West Central Africa, Nigeria, you know, what is the other one? Gabon, Gambia, you know, Senegal, you know, Gambia, you know. Countries like that, so-called Sierra Leone, like, and what they did was they called themselves trying to put together a piece on the so-called burgeoning African middle class. And so what they do is, so what they did was they took a young brother, and this young brother, you know, he's dressed, like a gentleman, you know. He has the tie and the colorful tie and the vest and the shirt and the pants and the top hat and the shoes. And then they put him in there and they said, look, you know, the rising young black successful Africans and whatnot, which is all bullshit and a smokescreen, and which develops as a form of classism in Africa, which is their product of capitalism. And this is how they do it. And this is the new shit. And so this exchange program is no more nor less than what? Africans receiving a Western-style education, therefore a Western-style view of the world. And a Western-style view now, all of a sudden, of even your own homeland. And that is how it operates. That is how it works. It is no different than what they did the first time when they went there, or at least what will be recorded as the first time, somewhere around 1451 or somewhere up in there, where they went there, you know, so-called founders land, you know, and they had taken the first group of Africans, and what did they do with them? Took these Africans, and they brought them back to Europe. What did they do? First thing on their mind was teaching them what? English. So they could become bilingual, not because it was some great care and that they wanted to be together as one. And no, it's bullshit. They taught them English for one purpose. So when they educated them and let them dress like them, wear their clothes, and they educated them, and upon completion of that education, what did they do? They put them back on the ship, and they brought them back over there. And now they were able to communicate with the rest of their brothers and sisters that they knew when they were younger. And now they could communicate with their brothers and sisters because they were bilingual. And so they would therefore translate to them the whims of the Europeans. And so it created a class. And this is how it's orchestrated. So that's how they went in. And that's how they was able to get in and then establish themselves. It's an exchange program. And so it's just much more sophisticated now. You see? And so in the midst of that, over time periods, what took place? The people having become colonized. And I just... No, this word, just comes up over this movie called Total Recall, and they say, you know, it got lobotomized, you know, like sort of like fried, like, you know what I'm saying, but mentally fried, you see what I'm saying? But one thing naturally leads to the next, that colonialism, the highest stage of capitalism is imperialism. And the highest stage of imperialism is neocolonialism, as that was so well articulated by Kwame Nkrumah, who's the leader, I believe, of Ghana, who himself had received the Western education. And Nkrumah, being conscious of it, attempted to use that education to bring Ghana up to the position that the Europeans were in. And they had been courting Nkrumah. And it was predicated on energy, the building, the constructing of a dam, which would bring energy to Ghana. And Nkrumah was no individualist. Nkrumah had said, like Garvey did, Africa for the Africans in his own way, and bringing Africa under United Federated States. What they have here was called the United Snakes of America, where they was talking about the United States of Africa. And so what happened? He was betrayed. By who? The Anglo-American establishment. And so these brothers, one thing I say about I've talked with, you know, a couple of brothers from the continent, and you know, you get the impression that they really learned from people like Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba. You know, they really studied and really learned and prepared for the liberation process of the mother continent and stuff. You know? Of course, you know, it's a number of things, you know. And look, and by the way, you know, we had finished talking about last week we were talking about this dude named Ahmad Muhammad. I actually wanted to, you know, close it out, but we'll get back to it. You know, sometimes, you know, we might have to go into a part two. You know what I'm saying? Because we don't want to, you know, just be skimming over shit, you know, when we really want to paint an intricate picture, you know, to hit you to the game, how it's played, so therefore people get understand why, you know, the conditions are the way that they are, and you know, we supposed to be messed up. Why wouldn't we be? If I've been subjected to, I give you an example. Yeah, nothing. This thing just come to mind. This movie about Tarzan, where they brought Tarzan up into the modern age, right? You know, new 20th century Tarzan shit, right? And they had made this movie, I believe, back in the 90s or the 80s or the 90s or something like that, right? And I forget this actor's name. But anyway, what they did was they sort of like kind of not restructured the Tarzan story, but you know, kind of put a twist, like, you know, he'd been raised in you know, in the jungle, right? You know, by the animals and shit like that, right? And this is a classic example of what I'm talking about, and people understand this because when he went back to civilization, he went back to Europe, and I believe it was England, right? And, you know, just finding this baby, and she brings him back, and then, you know, or whatever, you know, he grows up, and then she meets him, and then she tries to bring him back to Europe. And what does he do? You know, this Victorian age shit, the fine china and the silverware, you know, this etiquette shit, with a fork and a spoon and the butter knife placed on this side of the plate and proper way, this, that, and all this kind of shit, right? And then etiquette class. So here they take a white boy who had been raised with the animals in the jungle called Tarzan, and then they bring him back to civilization and then try to reconstitute him. So what did he do? He acts out, you know, he's uncivilized. And they understand it. That's why they kept on trying to, you know, reconstitute him. And this was this movie that they made. This was this movie. It's a classic example of what I'm talking about. It only applies to the Europeans, though. But when it comes to black and brown people, them niggas crazy. I don't know what's wrong with them niggas. He done lost his mind. I don't know what happened to him. Like this new shit now, bipolarism, mental issues and whatnot. Shit, the pigs love that. Because they can pretend it on stage. You know, but this is the type of psychology after 500 years of white terror, and even some of us, we don't get it. You know, we like, shit, you know, man, that nigga crazy. You know, he had me to be, you know, on the third floor. You know, you need to be a straitjacket. You need to be in a straitjacket right there with him. If you understand why he is the way he is, you see. And this is a societal effects, it's a cultural effects. And this is no made up story. I can't make this shit up. It is what it is. And this is the type of understanding. This is what we talking about. This is the type of understanding. This is how people gonna come out from underneath all of this shit. If we pierce into it and we go into it in order to go forward, we go back and then to go forward to be able to understand what we up against. See? But this is what they did, you know, in Africa. There have been those who have come along who did what we're attempting to do tonight with this topic. And they was able to figure it out. And so you had Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. Malcolm X used to speak about some of these individuals, you know. And I remember him saying, you know, Patrice Lumumba. And it was because of him that I had gotten intrigued by not just the person he was talking about, but his name for some reason just stood out to me, Lumumba. You know, and I knew the name was African. But it was just something about the name, like, you know. And some of the brothers in the 60s, you know, the Black Power, the Black Pride, we have European names and stuff, right? You know, colonized people. Yeah. And some of those brothers, that was one of the names that some brothers renamed themselves to reconnect with the continent. And they, you know, changed the name to Lumumba. It became a first name for some of them. It became a second name for some of the brothers and sisters. And these brothers were in the movement, the revolutionary militant movement, revolution movement, Black Panther Party movement, underground movement. You know, the Black Pride, the resurgence of Black Pride, the Afro, you know, being proud of one's physical features and shit, you know. And so there's a, you know, Lumumba was, you know, he was able to articulate the position of the African people in the Congo. He said it flat out, look, the Belgians don't own shit. This don't belong to no Belgians. Shit's under our feet, and we've been here since Lord knows when, and the shit belong to us, and they'll have no say-so in what we can and what we can't have, and the shit's under our feet, the land our ancestors. And it was because of that they made up their minds that Lumumba had to go. Murder Lumumba, and to my understanding, not only murdered them, as the savages that they are, they have been calling us savages. But the savages that have been historically, what did they do? They chopped his body up into pieces. But he was 40 years old. And it's something about that number 40. Malcolm was 40, 39, 40 years old. You know, he was assassinated. There's something about this number. Brilliant. And so hopefully these brothers today, in particular Ibrahim Traore in Burkina Faso, and Burkina Faso has a legacy. When I got wind of this young brother myself, first thing came to mind was Thomas Sankara. You know, brilliant revolutionary. Again, you know, same, around the same age, like, you know, the same thing, like, you know. You know what I'm saying? He was a Marxist revolutionary / Pan-Africanist. And he had done, well, let's see, 9303 13. He had done 40 years ago, 40 years ago, right? It's 2023, and it was 1983. That Thomas Sankara was successful in a revolutionary coup and had become the leader of the people in Burkina Faso until he was assassinated in 1987. It was brilliant. What is a Marxist revolutionary / Pan-Africanist? But I wanted to say that because you know, I would assume at least this young brother is following the steps of Thomas Sankara, learning from Thomas Sankara's experience, and of course understanding, stepping into that arena, the possibility of assassination, but he can learn from Thomas Sankara's experience. So this is a resurgence, if you will, or legacy that he's carrying out. That he's, you know, in the line, in the footsteps. They're like the day, like hearing the snakes. In the words, some of us, we stand on the shoulders of the Black Panther Party that formed in '66 in California in October, you know, and you know. Chairman Fred, Little Chairman Fred, Big Chairman Fred, and the Little Chairman Fred, and you know, when you talking about being Black Panther Cub, you know, and so today he's the national chairman of the Black Panther Party Cubs. So we stand on the shoulders of those who have come before him, and so this is what we would like to understand in Burkina Faso with this young brother. You know? And of course, we know as we speak, the CIA, the MI6, and even Mossad, that's the Israeli version of the CIA, right, are plotting something as we speak, because we'd be foolish to think that they wasn't, even if they ain't doing. See, but he appears to be the highlight of these so-called coups. Now, let me say this here. Man, we ain't going to rush this shit, man. We ran out of time. We'll come back next week. Again, this is an update on Mother Africa. and you know, those who listen, man, you know, don't be afraid. Don't be shy. Don't be timid. Whether you're listening, you want to comment, speak, whatever, you know what I'm saying, press one on your phone and we'll get you in. You know, this is People's Radio, you know what I'm saying, Independence of People Radio, political education platform as we consider it. Okay? But, yeah, so, you know, he's like the highlight of this, some would say, Arab Spring, you know, African version of the Arab Spring. Now, but I'm a bit cautious about that shit because I know for a fact that Arab Spring shit was the CIA had a hand in it, you know. And part of that, you know, the overthrow in Egypt, the overthrow in Libya and whatnot, you know, these, you know, so-called Arab countries. And no coincidence, what you're basically looking at is, again, you know, certain segments of the Arab population being used as proxies for the what's referred to as the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant community, you know, WASP, right? Quasi-religious war that's still going on. It's been taking place for 1,000 years between the Christians and the Muslims. right? So, you know, this rising up, you know, of young African leaders, and we haven't even mentioned Julius Malema in Southern Africa. We didn't even mention him yet. That's a whole nother chapter. But we're going to take our time. You know, it ain't often we, you know, every week, you know, we discuss, you know, Mother Africa. So we periodically enter, you know, our beautiful homeland that the Europeans have done a heck of a fucking job and tried to destroy us. You know, ecologically, you know, so environmentally and whatnot, you know. But the spirit of these brothers would come before them, and we will hope that that's what that is. We will hope that is not some type of spontaneous shit that takes place and then it dies out. The young, we believe that the young people, those who have been keeping up with the young people, have reached the brink. And just like the young people here in the snakes have reached the brink. But the potential appears to be there. When I talked about these northern countries, North African countries like Mali and whatnot, you know, the French had ruled North Africa. You know, that colonized, you know, Northern Africa from pretty much bordering Egypt all the way up to, you know, the Atlantic or what have you, you know, the Algeria and, you know, these countries like Morocco and stuff like that, right? Which is what led to the Algerian Revolution in the late 50s. It was part of this wave of revolutionary overthrows of the colonial governments, you know. But this case with Mali, you know, you'd be real tricky. Of course, the factionalism, where you take the African population and split them along quasi-religious lines, use the strategy, tactic, the boogeyman tactic that Machiavelli had taught the prince in the book that now I refer to as The Prince, a strategy on how a prince is supposed to keep his hold and to keep his rule intact and whatnot, and rule and dominate over the people's subjects. But they use a Machiavellian strategy, which is now known as terrorism. As another excuse to keep a presence in countries like Mali. And so the French really haven't went anywhere. And this is why you see the European in recent times come out. We're not leaving. They have the gall to tell the indigenous people that they're not leaving. That's like us going over there to France, taking this shit over, and then some years go by, and then the French, you know, the French, look, they gonna get violent. You know, they get violent with each other. You know, you see some of these government shit, some of these contradictions take place. You know, like in Greece and whatnot, you know, I forget the country where they killed the young dude, the PS killed, and then they just went on to just fucking rampage. So violence is like second nature to European people. You know, I mean, that's their MO. You know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, people, you know, have the audacity and the gall, you know, to ask, are we advocate violence and whatnot, you know. But anyway, that's like, you know, the Africans and Mali going over there and taking over France, or Algeria's going and taking over France and telling the motherfucking French what they're going to do, and the French rise up, and it's Manny Lee, and Algeria says, no, we ain't going no goddamn way. Yeah. So the type of arrogance on a part of the French, you know, and this is what lead to confrontation. This is what lead natural conflict. But because they've used such a sophisticated system, you know, the Machiavellian strategy of terrorism, factionalism along quasi-religious lines, And also what I mean by that quasi-religious lines also has something to do with traditional African belief systems too. Indigenous African belief systems, which a lot of indigenous Malians still hold on to. A lot of those Malians were able to sustain the bombardment of Islam and Christianity and was able to hold on to their indigenous belief system that the Europeans just referred to as naturalism. If they don't call it paganism, idolatry, primitivism, or what's the other one? But anyway, you know, the Muslims refer to him as a kafir. It's a word that the Muslims use called kafir, K-A-F-I-R. And that's a derogatory term along the lines of unbeliever, right? But they're able to hold on to the traditional system, which means that they're still able to practice their indigenous rituals, showing appeasement to the God they've always known more than any other people who make the claim to the shit. You know, the Bible speaks about how the Israelites had to make an offering, you know, offer up a lamb and whatnot, a burnt offering, right? So who's been following him more, the one who speaks it or the ones who actually carry it out and who are actually the ones who are being described in the scriptures? But they were able to hold on to it, even in the Caribbean, you know, parts of the Caribbean, you know, Brazil and whatnot, you know, still able to hold on to the indigenous belief system, right? But they've been able to take the it can be really tricky. I mean, I'm gonna try to like put this together, like give an idea. One group has to be the rebel group, right? One group has to be the rebel group, and which would appear to be the Muslims. In some instances, right? Then the indigenous group is fighting for what? Their sovereignty, their land that they've always known, being encroached upon by who? The imperialists and the Muslims. And so what do the imperialists do? It's a Machiavellian strategy. They'll go to them and say, hey, these Muslim terrorists, they got it out for y'all. And this is how it works. This is how it works. And if they have to turn those so-called rebels, where they're turning them against the other faction, and the one thing that they have in common is what? They're both black. They're both black and brown people. It's just that the Muslims, the black and brown Muslims, they have Arabic names. They have Arabic names. And, of course, as a result of Muslim imperialism, Arab imperialism, the confiscation, the takeover of North Africa, the expansion of Islam into North Africa, which is why you see, you know, Burkina Faso's leader, you know, part name Ibrahim is Arabic. His last name his first name is Arabic, his last name is African. Right? Traore. So this is how it works. You see. And so in the meantime, the French can use the strategy of imperial of terrorism to stay there and join the natives and make them think that they're there for them and they're battling terrorism to keep their presence there, over the natural resources. and some of these young leaders are catching on to it. They're catching on to it. And this is why, you know, they are successful in pulling coups. If you take the Sudan, John Garang, who was there in Sudan, brilliant. John Garang was able to get the people to understand that the Europeans are Europeans and imperialists are the imperialists, regardless of you're Muslim or you're a traditional African, and that they got it out for both of us, and that we can cross those lines because some of us are also Christian. And so he was a sort of Chairman Fred in the Sudan, where he was able to organize them and bring them together and cross these lines, these religious factional lines, and he focused on one group, one thing. That was the imperialists. Those who were in bed with them, they had to be weeded out. If we're going to make war on them, we're going to put the white man aside and we're going to clean house. And that's what made John Garang so brilliant. So what was the whole purpose about Sudan? To split that, to split the shit up into two or three countries. Right now today we got this is Sudan. There's Sudan and then the country of South Sudan. Right there. It's the same thing they did on a larger scale in the continent of Africa, where you have Africa and then you have a country called South Africa. South Africa, Africa. You know, like Atlanta, Georgia. You know, like Georgia, United States. Right? But let me correct that, United States. But that's the whole point. And so now you see, you look at the map and see Sudan. Why is it South Sudan? The same objective and goal is what? The natural resource. Sudan is rich in oil and other shit. And so the imperialists, what they did, they studied the shit. And this is where we go wrong. And this is where we miss at, right? This is where we miss. This could be some of us, even in the military movement, our Achilles heel. We get so drunk off the AR that we tend to forget about some other shit. Right? So this is what they do. I mean, talking about down to the minutest detail. Down to the minutest detail. Somebody said a long time ago, man, look, you gotta like your mind, you know. And he said, but look, he said, you should study geography and geology. That's what he said. He said, you study geography and geology, especially when it comes to Africa. I've never gotten that. And I see what he mean now. That's what they've done. They've studied geology and they've applied it to what? To the Sudan. There's an institute, the James Baker Institute at Rice University right now. That's all they do. They just study energy. So they got a think tank just for Russia alone. Just for Russia alone. And you got people like George Soros that would fund that shit called the Open Society. Why is it called Open Society? It's called Open Society because they want to open up their society to what? To capitalism. You even got some quiet as kept. Some of these black organizations today that was out there with the people who was raging over the lynching of George Floyd being financed by the same George Soros who has open society agents in Russia right now. Even in China, same shit. Look it up. I ain't make this shit up. I'll make it up. He's poured millions of dollars into this movement, into this so-called New Age post-George Floyd black militant movement. I ain't make this shit up, man. I tell you. Can't make it up. You know? And so, you know, you draw a correlation between that and the strategies that they're using on the continent. There's no difference. There's no difference whatsoever. To keep Africa open to the whims of the capitalists in a much more sophisticated form. And we haven't even gotten around to the African Union yet. Even that. What's his role where it play at? You know, it's a number thing. We might move part. We'll be back next week. Maybe do a series on it, right? And like I said, so much. You know, the corporation. which of course is the benefactor, because of his ambitions, has to keep his claws into the continent. Right? Because they set up their industrial age as a dependency on natural resources that wasn't native to their lands, that wasn't indigenous to their lands. So they sent all these agents in the 19th century. They've even made a movie of this shit. It's either how Stanley found Livingstone or how Livingstone found Stanley. This is a movie they made. And these are two explorers who were financed by the white ruling class of Europe. To do what? To go into the dark continent. You know, to travel through this shit, like, you know, the heart of Africa, the heart of darkness. I think it's a book called The Heart of Darkness. Right? And they went there. There's no more, no less than agents and scouts. And this is how they were able to open up Africa. And they came back. And so they would compete. The English had their man. The Germans were like, shit, we're gonna send one of our own. The Belgians said, well, we'll send one too. So they was competing. See who man could cross Africa from north to south, from east to west first, who could cross it. I mean, they risk disease, everything. You know, of course, you know, being Europeans, non-melanated people and whatnot, susceptible to all kind of shit. You know, malaria and whatnot, you know, yellow fever, all these different types of things, right? But this is what they was able to do, and which would give you an idea of the present condition and the struggle to transform it. And so, like I said, you know, hopefully this is what this is. You know, we've seen them, you know, and the Europeans revamped themselves to reinvent themselves in various forms and contrivances and stuff to keep their claws within the continent. And the young people in the meantime are growing more and more discontent or whatever, being disenfranchised, inheriting disenfranchisement and whatnot. Even the Nelson Mandela thing, you know, with Winnie Mandela, the orchestrated effort to get Nelson Mandela away from Winnie Mandela. You know, the whole ticker tape parade in New York City. Yeah. All of that. And this is the type of lessons that the brothers and sisters on the continent have to know and understand and learn from in order to free Africa, in order to carry out the ideological framework that was laid down by the likes of such people as Kwame Nkrumah, a lesser known brother elder. What is his name? Because, you know, being under French rule, of course, you know, a lot of us took on French names. His name is on the tip of my goddamn tongue. It's a little small, little tiny little book that he wrote, but fascinating. Very fascinating little book. I mean, a little book. I'm trying to think of his name, where he was talking about this attitude, right? The Negro showing this attitude, you know, in the 50s. So the Negro had developed an attitude. And so what somebody did was they fused the two words together, and it was called negritude. So we're proud to say that we have a negritude. It was negritude, you see. But it's an astonishing small book. And the way he was able to piece things together and then, you know, spit it out with and get people to understand it. They were trying to think of his name. But it was brilliant. And he talked about colonialism. And he talked about the colonized mind, the colonized Negro, and how the colonized Negro had to be transformed. Unless the colonized African Negro would harm himself. Could not see himself even standing in the mirror. He could not see himself. What he saw was a white man. And so, therefore, those are mental issues. You see? Same thing with Frantz Fanon. Same shit. You know, we talk about the black skin, white mask. A classic way of putting it, black skin, white mask. You know? All for the sake of staying in control of the mother continent. And as I said, you know, taking what some would say, like hearing them have the brightest minds and pay for their education in Europe. To my understanding, the three that would come to mind would be Harvard, the Sorbonne in France, University of London, or All Souls College, or Oxford University. Yeah. One of those, which is in Great Britain, and even the university, one of the universities in of all places, Israel, and educate them there. And then before you know it, 25 years later, you see him running for president. You don't even know. And all the money is dumped and poured in behind them. You see? And the people not even understanding, not even knowing, have a clue. No. And that's how it works. I give you an example like the Arab world. Hamid Karzai. Educated by Europeans, I believe, right here in America. And Hamid Karzai had ended up working with such likes the oil cartels or the people who, have a high stakes in running pipelines and whatnot. You know, those who construct them, right? Construction companies. Like Halliburton, Bechtel and Root, it's Brown and Root and Bechtel. So when Karzai finished his education, he joined one of those, and then he had got him a position, a high position in one of the companies. And it was all orchestrated, it was all by design. And so when they call themselves overthrowing the Taliban or the so-called Al-Qaeda terrorism and all this kind of shit, right, Osama bin Laden, and the takeover of Afghanistan, what did they do? Who did they install as the new leader? It was one Hamid Karzai by design. And this is the same strategy that they've used in Africa. Start off in some company, in some corporation. And then when you get this position, what do? They put it all up for the whole world to see. You know? And everybody's all proud. The first African leader of the UN. You know? Same strategy, you know, Machiavellian strategy. It's Machiavellian. Machiavelli, one of the instructions or one of the strategies go with Machiavelli and form the friends that you have to make them feel like they belong. Make them feel like they belong. It gives them a sense of pride. If you make them feel like they belong. And this is what they've done. You make them feel like they belong until the real reality steps in and it becomes a contradiction. And this is what leads to people developing an attitude. Aimé Césaire is his name. AimeCesaire. And he wrote a little book, I think it's called The Discourse on Colonialism. Anybody who really wants to understand that shit, I recommend you get that little book and read it. You'll never be the same. For those who claim to be Pan-Africanists, it would be right up your alley. Along with Fanon's incredible angles on shit. You know, we come to the end of the line here. And this has been fun, you know, speaking as an individual, but as an organization, I'm quite sure I'm speaking for my comrades, too. This is what we like to do. We enjoy trying to inform our people, to raise our people's conscious level. But we'll come back. Again and again, if we have to, we really want to go into it. We want to paint a real intricate picture of an update on Africa to basically defend against this sort of thing that's and I don't want to mischaracterize anything, but you kind of get the sense of like this. And there's always somebody working behind the scenes, you know, sort of like this utopian kind of thing without realizing the reality of it all. And, of course, the sacrifices that must take place. You know? But I firmly believe in the determination, you know, the conviction, especially of the younger people, which have always been the stock and barrel of all of the political movements of Africa. If anybody understood that, it was Winnie Mandela, you know, establishing a youth league. You know, recreation or sports. You know. And of course, you know, we can adapt that idea right here in the Snakes. Youth Power Nation, you know, a vision that can become a reality right here in the Snakes. And of course, we'd have to deal with a lot of internal shit. We have to deal with a lot of forces who, you know, will try to convince us that this is the way to go and that the corporations can assist us. But no such thing. No such thing. You know, it's like asking the devil to give you a brick, which he'll never do unless you break him off. So we're gonna pick back up next week. So stay tuned, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, for part two of an update on Mother Africa, brought to you by People's Political Party in Defense of the People's Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Chairman Nat, and my co-host, Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, and our assault technician on the 1-2, Sister Amanda Oshun, our National Minister of Communication, who make things happen. And who in every sense of the word is our national minister of communication. You know, sometimes she, you know, she lets people know she's my, how she says it, my second brain, you know. And, shit, I wouldn't trade in it with nothing in the world. So stay tuned next week. And we say all power to the people, black power to black people in specific, and the whole rule. The battle cry for true freedom through liberation. We'll see you next week. We out.